From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll hear from businesses located inside the security perimeter for the upcoming Republican National Convention. Then, we'll hear from a coalition planning to protest the RNC about its legal battle with the city.
You know, the city is trying to get us to agree to something that's less than our full First Amendment rights, and we're not going to do that. You know, we're going to exercise it to the fullest extent.
Plus, our latest group chat conversations explores the influence and impact of Black elected leaders here in Milwaukee.
A Black face in that electoral seat doesn't necessarily mean good things for our community, because it's just a strong person. And what we're looking for is a strong people.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Milwaukee is less than 1 week away from hosting the Republican National Convention. Ahead of the four-day event, the Secret Service has released a security perimeter map that outlines the area of downtown Milwaukee where access will be restricted to those with credentials. But inside that perimeter are bars, restaurants, and other businesses that aren't sure how this will impact them. To learn more, Lake Effect's Ex-Grit Nunez hit the streets to ask businesses inside the perimeter how they're adjusting for the RNC.
RNC organizers say they expect to welcome around 50,000 visitors to the city and are excited about putting Milwaukee in a national spotlight. Omar Shack is the co-owner of 3rd Street Market Hall, which lies in the security perimeter. He's also on the RNC host committee, which lobbied for the event to be in Milwaukee.
You really want to win these large-scale conventions because it brings so many cameras on our city, 15,000 credential cameras, bringing a lot of delegates, members of the media. You're bringing in a lot of different visitors from around the world. And anytime they can come in and see what we believe this city has been world-class from day one, we want to do it.
But not all business owners within the security perimeter share the same enthusiasm. Evan Pack is the co-founder of Vulture Space, a nonprofit bicycle shop inside the former Grand Avenue Mall. He says he's worried the perimeter security checks will discourage people from coming in.
I don't agree with it, but I don't want to have a security, anyone like checking me when I'm going to work or something.
The RNC security perimeter has two zones. The hard security zone requires everyone within it to have credentials issued by the Secret Service. It's a smaller area just around the main convention sites of the Pfizer Forum, Panther Arena, and Bayard Center. The soft security zone is a larger area. It extends roughly from West Cherry Street on the north to Clybourne Street on the south, and from North 9th Street on the west to the east side of the Milwaukee River. It's open to the public, but vehicles will need to be screened at 5 designated checkpoints. Derek Fungful is the owner of the King and I Thai restaurant on North MLK Drive. Just 2 blocks from the Pfizer Forum, it's in the soft security zone. He says he's unsure whether the RNC will be a boom or bust for his business.
I'm anxious about it, you know. As a business owner, that's never a good thing to not know how it's going to be. We love it when you have reservations. We know that there's a convention here. I don't know to what extent that's going to help or hurt us.
Fungful says since his restaurant gets a lot of takeout orders, he doesn't know if customers will want to drive through one of the vehicle screening checkpoints to pick up food. He also hasn't gotten any big reservations from groups here for the event, so he hopes foot traffic is high during the convention. But if you walk just one block down the street, it's a different story. Major Goolsby's, a popular Milwaukee sports bar, finds itself on both sides of the hard and soft security zones. The Secret Service even highlighted Major Goolsby's on its security perimeter map to show there will be public access during the convention. Drew Olson is the manager at the bar.
We do think it's fantastic that the official Secret Service security map designates Major Goolsby's. There are no other businesses specifically listed on there, so at minimum, one would hope that anybody looking at the map would say, boy, I got to check out this Major Goolsby's. It must be a really important place.
With the bar expecting an uptick in business, Olson says it will be all hands on deck. But what about businesses in the more restrictive, hard security zone? They can only be accessed by people with credentials, like delegates, volunteers, and media members. This includes all of the bars and restaurants inside the Deer District. Fat Tuesday is a frozen daiquiri bar steps away from the entrance to Pfizer Forum. Despite the limited set of credentialed customers, Lisa Brown, an employee at the daiquiri bar, says she's holding out hope that business stays flowing.
I feel like it might be pretty busy because there's a lot of people from down south, like Florida and other places, that are familiar with Fat Tuesdays. And I feel like to see something familiar here in Wisconsin will draw people here more.
But at the end of the day, all of these downtown businesses within the two security perimeters have one thing in common. They don't know for sure how the RNC will affect business. For WUWM, I'm Excaret Nunez.
In the run-up to the RNC, local activists have been locked in a battle with the city. The Coalition to March on the RNC says the city is violating its First Amendment rights. The group has been asking Milwaukee officials to approve a permit that would allow them to protest within sight and sound of the Pfizer Forum. With the help of the American Civil Liberties Union, the group filed a federal lawsuit in June. Omar Flores co-chairs the Coalition to March on the RNC. He joins WUWM's Lena Tran to share what the group has planned.
What have your days, weeks been looking like in the run-up to the RNC?
Honestly, at this point, it's all kind of been a blur. And it's been good. You know, I want to be clear about that. It's a really good blur. But the issue is that, like, you know, before it was like, it was hard to convince people almost like that this is real, like this is happening in our city. We need to get ready. And then I feel like it was about like maybe a month ago where I feel like everyone's like, oh my God, like these folks are going to be in our city. Like we need to do something. And so we've had a huge upsurge in support, which has been really good for us.
It's hard to ignore that you've been locked in this battle with the city over the permit to march and over the security zones. I'm wondering if you can just talk about why the city's designated protest zones and parade route aren't suitable for your group.
Yeah, so our demands from the very beginning, as soon as we knew that, you know, the RNC was going to be at the Pfizer Forum, which is a little over a year ago, we had filed for a permit to march within sight and sound of the front doors of the RNC. And from the very beginning, we were clear about that request. The city has refused to play ball. Up until we filed the lawsuit, we genuinely had not heard anything from the city. And so the city has not been playing in good faith. And so that's why we filed the lawsuit, you know, and in terms of the route that partially goes into the hard zone, it's not our intention to go into the hard zone. The issue with the city is that that zone was actually supposed to be open for a very long time. Pier Marquette is actually where they were telling us to be. And due to Republican complaining and, you know, letters and pressure, the Secret Service and the city have decided to put Pier Marquette behind a hard zone, which limits the new route that we've come up with. You know, our route before looked a lot closer to the RNC. We were willing to be a little bit flexible with the city. And, you know, even as we've been flexible with the city, they instead to decide to put our path behind a hard zone. And so we're hoping that we'll be able to have that no longer be a hard zone through our court battle.
And at this point, the city has not approved your permit to march anyways. You know, what kind of pushback do you anticipate?
So in my 10 years as an organizer, we have never once pulled out a permit to march. It is very abnormal to do that here in Milwaukee. Very few organizations do it. And generally speaking, I would say like 95% of the time, the police leave us alone. We're allowed to do what we want to do. We keep people safe. We know how to direct traffic. We have medics. We've never had an incident at any of our marches. You know, we expect the same treatment. You know, Milwaukee shouldn't change how they do things just because the Republicans are here.
So the city's proposed parade route would take groups by Baird Center. Can you talk about why that's an issue for you versus like Pfizer Forum?
Our rally is going to be just one day. It's going to be on that Monday during the opening remarks of the RNC, which are going to be hosted at the Pfizer Forum. And so for us to march by the Baird Center, it's pretty just unimportant to us, right? Because like the Republicans are not going to be there. Additionally, we've had our demand within sight and sound of the front doors of the Pfizer Forum. We've said that from the very start. And so the city trying to sell us Baird, you know, trying to sell us this North End park that, you know, it's going to be near where people are getting in and out, where it's where media is. You know, the city is trying to get us to agree to something that's less than our full First Amendment rights. And we're not going to do that. You know, we're going to exercise it to the fullest extent.
Yeah, yeah. How many people are you expecting to be marching alongside you?
That's been the big question. And, you know, we have around 90 organizations signed on to our coalition, a lot of them from Wisconsin, a lot of them from, you know, all across the nation. And, you know, I mean, people are pretty fired up around what's going on, I mean, especially after the debate. I think people are seeing the importance of marching regardless of the convention, right? That there needs to be some direct action. That's really going to be the only way that we're going to be able to advocate for our own agendas.
Understanding that it's hard to have an estimate for how many people these orgs are going to bring into the fold, but are you thinking like hundreds, thousands?
In terms of people coming out to the protest, a very conservative estimate would be around like 1,500. Like we're expecting that at like a bare minimum. And we're thinking more realistically around like 5,000. You know, we were maybe projecting lower, but when we talked with some of our national partners, especially over there in Chicago, they were like, you should bump the numbers up. Like, we have a lot of folks wanting to come up.
Interesting.
You know, Milwaukee PD and Chicago PD have been working so closely together, and I think that emphasizes the need, you know, for us organizers across cities to also be working together very closely.
Yeah. You've been going through all these hurdles, and you're in this lawsuit with the city. I mean, is it affecting your ability to just plan the coalition actions? Like, would you rather be just like working on that stuff?
Yeah, honestly, I mean, it's both good and bad, right? Like our job as organizers, I've always said, is to like turn the bad things into good things. And, you know, we knew that when we got into this permit struggle that the city was going to put up a fight. And we knew that they weren't going to operate in good faith. And we knew that they were very likely not going to just hand it right over to us, that it would probably end up in a lawsuit or something. You know, and what I hope people realize is that, you know, that this sets like a terrible precedent, right? Like, I mean, we wanted to show people that even if we do everything the right way, exactly the way that they're telling us to, and even through the shifted goalpost, right? Because we filled out the regular permit application and then they passed an ordinance midway stating that, no, we changed this. You have to do it a different way now. We did that. And we still did not get anywhere with the city. And so like that sends a terrible message from the city, right? That if you try to play by the rules, like you're not going to get anything done. And so, I mean, I thought it was really interesting that Chief Norman had actually said, you know, that it wouldn't be a protest if the rules weren't bent a little. And so that's exactly what we're doing, is that we're bending the rules a little bit because it's a protest and that's what we have to do. And yeah, I wish I could focus on other things, right? Because I think that, while I don't buy into a lot of the fear-mongering that's been going on around the RNC, I do think that it does slightly increase the risk of arrest, you know, if we are marching without a permit and, you know, all this national pressure from Republicans for the city to react to protests differently. You know, it's kind of a wild card as to how things could turn out. But, you know, we feel very confident with the mitigating measures that we've taken. You know, security was always a part of our plan. So honestly, it's not really that much more on our plate. Like we always prepare for worst case scenario, even though we expect the best.
Can you talk more about some of the major partners in your coalition?
Yeah. So the Milwaukee Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression, which I helped refound here in Milwaukee and had also been a longtime member of. You know, I think that they played an extremely important role in being able to organize for the RNC. They have a lot of experience, you know, in dealing with like a police repression and hosting marches and keeping people safe. They've been incredibly helpful. Reproductive Justice Action Milwaukee has played a huge role. Students for a Democratic Society at UW-Milwaukee, they ran the encampment incredibly. And a lot of the names that I just mentioned in terms of organizations, they helped make that encampment what it was. And it notably went without incident. You know, we notably were able to de-escalate issues, you know, with agitators and things like that. You know, that's stuff that a lot of people don't know how to do or honestly don't care to do. And, you know, we've been able to successfully run things. I think it's instilled a lot of faith of those people in Milwaukee that, you know these organizations. They know that they're going to do everything they can to keep people safe.
Yeah. Is there any kind of excitement on the behalf of the Milwaukee organizers, like to have this big platform, or is it counterweighted by, you know, strong opposition that people have to the RNC?
Honestly, the organizers are extremely excited. You know, I think we maybe had a opposite reaction to some other folks that were very much like, I'm leaving Milwaukee, you know, I'm not doing this. And like I said, I mean, our job is to turn like bad thing into a good thing, right? And this is a really bad thing happening to our city. And that means a really good thing is going to come out. You know, a lot of us had organized the march on the DNC. You know, I was also a spokesperson for that coalition back in 2020. And we saw what it could do for us, right? And so this is like an opportunity for people to really see like what we've been doing and like not only just doing, right? Like we're not doing this because we're crazy. It's what we've been successfully able to accomplish through organization. I think the biggest hurdle sometimes to get people to join an organization is a sort of this deep sense of nihilism, right? But the argument that we're offering as a coalition, you know, whether it was a march on the RNC or the march on the DNC, is that the only way to actually get things changed is through direct action. And I feel like that specific march is like a great example of how we win change through those actions.
Mm-hmm. If you had to boil it down, you know, what would you say is the main message that y'all have for the RNC?
You know, we don't want their racist and reactionary agenda here in Milwaukee, and also that when we fight, we win. You know, nobody has ever won change by just sitting at home and wishing that things were better, right? There are things that you can do with your time to be able to create a better world. And so that's really the message we're trying to project. And I would also encourage people to look at some of the endorsing organizations, right? As a coalition spokesperson, I can't say too deeply as to, you know, what specific things people are fighting for, right? Because, you know, there's a wide variety of viewpoints in our coalition, right? We tried to make it as broad-based as possible. And so I would encourage people to see to the organizations that have supported this, right? Because, well, you know, the Democrats have mainly been in opposition to the Republicans in words. We are the opposition in action.
Are you worried about keeping people safe during this march that first day?
Actually, a lot of us in coalition leadership have been more worried about, like, the logistics of, like, making the most out of like a bad event that's happening here in Milwaukee, right? We're worried about like missing opportunities that we might not ever get again in the city. That's been mostly what's keeping us up at night, because the security stuff for us is like living and breathing. None of our organizers are strangers to protest situations that are like escalated. I mean, a lot of us were out there during Kenosha, during the Ferguson uprising even. You know, we've been in all different types of scenarios, and that's just us in Wisconsin, right? We have people from across the country with experiences in like Republican strongholds like Texas or Florida that do have like great experience in being able to guide on like how to keep people safe. You know, when the Republicans came here for their national debate back in August of 2023, we were the ones to lead that march without incident. And so honestly, I'm coming into this extremely confident, and all of our organizers are, and anyone that's worked with our organizations in the past that form the coalition, they know that they can trust us to keep people safe.
So I guess, you know, share your vision, best case scenario for what happens that day. What does it look like to you?
I think what we're going to see is people from all different walks of life. And I think that we're going to be seeing a lot of like very justifiably angry working class folks that don't want to see this in our city. And I think that the biggest ideal for us, like in a realistic sense, right, is that our agenda is one that becomes dominant versus the Republican agenda. The Republicans have all this money and all of this influence and all of this, you know, all of this that they've built over the years. I would really love it if that we had such a show of force that people are talking about our politics before they're talking about their politics. In a maybe less realistic sense, I would really love it if the Republicans just felt intimidated from coming at all, right? And, you know, while we have no illusions, obviously, about some of the extremist organizations that very much support the Republicans, I think on a vast majority scale, I think that they understand that they are like the minority in the country, that their ideas are actually not the ones that are popular and that ours are. And so I think that anything that drives that point home, you know, as a coalition, I think that's our ideal goal.
So there may be listeners who are hearing this and are like, I want to be there. I want to get involved. What should they do?
I heavily encourage people to be involved, even if they aren't, you know, really feeling the best about it. You know, we're always stronger in numbers. And we will be over in Red Arrow Park and starting to gather around 10 a.m. And so I would heavily encourage people to get there early. You know, who knows what the parking situation might look like. And yeah, just join us and get to know some of these organizations, and even more than that, continue organizing. There's a lot of really great people who have put a lot of their time and effort into this, and you know, we could continue to create the change in Milwaukee that we want to see.
Well, thank you so much, Omar, for joining me. Really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much for having us.
Omar Flores is a spokesperson and co-chair for the Coalition to March on the RNC. He spoke with WUWM's Lena Tran. If you have questions about the RNC, you can fill out our election survey. What you tell us will help inform the stories that you hear on Lake Effect and WUWM. You can also find frequently asked questions on the RNC at WUWM.com. In about 15 minutes, we'll learn about a program that's taking a new approach to teaching social studies in Milwaukee. But first, we'll hear a discussion about Black elected officials here in the city. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Group Chat is our new series that gets Milwaukeeans in conversation with each other, asking their own questions while we provide the mics and simply get out of the way. This month, we're hearing from local organizers around Milwaukee that want to talk about Milwaukee's Black electeds. They're calling this conversation, Black Faces in High Places Won't Save Us. Here's Dr. Monique Liston, Chief Strategist at Ubuntu Research and Evaluation, and Nate Gilliam, founder and director of Milwaukee Freedom Fund. They start their conversation talking about why they think the city courted the RNC.
I feel like the city as a whole is just salty. Like, we're just salty. And I mean that in the most academic and intellectual sense of not getting a fair shake. Because I think this push only came because of the DNC in 2020. Not that I'm saying that would have been a better platform to put out, but I feel like this push came because there was so much economic promise for the DNC. COVID happened, and the next opportunity was the RNC. And I feel like people were like, well, we gotta reclaim stuff. Unfortunately, we're in a space where now we're making space for a lot of hate to exist in the city, as if we don't have a city that's majority Black, a city that has a way more left-leaning, blue-leaning ethos.
I would agree with the saltiness. I think a lot of the decision-making or advocacy had it happened out of, like, public purview, like, yeah, before we even became. I think one of the first articles I ever saw was, like, we were one of the finalists. I was like, I didn't even know we were in the running. Like, when did that happen? You know, there was no real public warning to that. I guess the council also, like, voted unanimously to support this decision to move to get it. And I understand, like, some people thought it was, you know, a loss with the DNC because of the impact of the pandemic. But to follow it up with this convention post-January 6th, post the extreme right, white nationalist, white supremacist lurch of this country is just, to me, unacceptable.
I guess it makes a lot of sense, too, that you said, like, the Common Council voted for this, right? And this is right before we had that historic change in the Common Council where we have so many Black people holding those seats. And if there was any moment for us as a united community to say, we are not going to let the status quo, white supremacist, white nationalist political ethos prevail in this space, it was then. To say we're not going to allow that. And so when it doesn't happen, it's like we're in these false equivalencies of the Republican and Democratic Party as if we got to vote for this so we don't get that, when it's really not even two sides of the same coin, two colors of the same shade is really, you know, how close it is. And so it's hard for me not to sit in apathy.
Even the arguments that are made by the proponents that are, you know, mayor, county executive, and the folks that really worked hard to bring this convention here don't even stand up in terms of, like, the financial benefit. Or another argument they were kind of making was that it should give greater impact with the Republicans in the state legislature to kind of work bipartisanly to get certain things done. And, I mean, okay, the shared revenue deals passed, but Milwaukee is not benefiting from that deal. We essentially eroded our fire police commission. Mm-hmm. We've locked ourselves into essentially giving a significant portion of the resources that we do get from this sales tax increase to the police, you know, and we're already, you know, one of the most incarcerated places in terms of Black people in the country. They didn't even fight for Evers' proposed shared revenue deal, which actually would have benefited Milwaukee and not even had those same kind of negative impacts in terms of what that would mean for the Black community or expanding policing or things like that. So,
can I ask you a question?
Sure.
thinking about that, right, there's a long-term plan, political impact of something like the RNC being in the city. And like you said, these decisions were made ahead of time. All of a sudden, we knew. Thinking about that long-term and sort of the immediate political things that we're feeling in the city of, like, where the Common Council stands, the upcoming elections for our state representatives, where our school board is, how do you reconcile for the general voting public the connections between what's happening locally in these much smaller things to something like, we should have been more aware about the RNC coming?
I think they're related in ways of, like, a lot of so-called democratic processes that we have here are not that. Real decisions that impact the majority of us are made prior, before, like, now we're just experienced political theater to me, in a sense of, like, you know, certain votes or we come and testify or different things like that, where that has no real impact. The link there is, like, a lot of processes are incredibly undemocratic.
I concur. One of my, I don't want to say favorite, but one of the scholars I really respect, Fred Moten, always talks about Black people being in the position of the unthought. And if we are unthought of, which means not considered, not prioritized, marginalized, maligned, that means that we are never going to be at the center of any of the decisions that would make this system run, because we hold the position of the unthought. And so considering this, and I think this gets to, like, our broader conversation of, like, well, but there are Black folks in some of these positions.
You know, I'll say for me, like, you know, just individually, like, throughout our life and understanding history and, like, seeing, you know, Black people get positions of what it appears to be power, like, it does, like, in an emotional level, give you some, you know, symbolic, like, feeling of affirmation. But it's all this stuff that works internally. But I think once you settle down and, like, look at what the impact of how their leadership, how their work is going to impact the majority of Black people and actually specifically the most marginalized, if the politicians or leaders or whoever, like, kind of continue the train or maintain the status quo, I think that's what we should be, like, assessing. If we are improving the quality of life of Black people, are the Black leaders doing that, whatever policy change or whatever kind of things they're advocating for, very publicly or even privately? That's how we assess it. And I think you can make that assessment pretty quickly.
I agree. I think that assessment is a strategy, right? It's a voting strategy. It is a political strategy. And I'm not here to say that all political strategies are wrapped up in our electoral politics. I think that is a method of us organizing and thinking about power relationships, our pursuit of freedom, liberation overall. How do we get there and what does it look like? And I think I get struck too about accountability, right? Because there is putting folks in these positions, voting, right? That's what we do. We vote, they get in the position, right? And then once they're in that position, because we voted for them, the populace, they're accountable to us, right? But then there's the energy spent making sure that we're holding them accountable versus the energy that we need to spend in order to make sure people are conscious and aware versus the energy we need to spend to build so that folks can continue to have hope, love, joy, justice in the midst of all of this. And again, that gets me back to, like, I don't know what to do about my position of solidarity, what that looks like and how to operationalize it. And I'm really torn about the accountability, right? Because once you hold someone accountable in the voting space, that means we need to do recalls, we need to go to meetings, we need to show up. And each of those meetings are time away from our families that we're trying to build with, time away from the study groups that we know that are necessary, time away from all the things that we know are we want to institutionalize towards our freedom dreams. And so how do we balance, or how do you suggest we should balance those realities?
I think accountability is an interesting thing within electoral politics and, like, the connection of people's policy and their engagement with communities. But I think, just to back up a step, because I think, at least I see sometimes, like, when people run for office or they're trying to be something, they do a lot of signaling in a lot of different ways. And one of the things that in particular, I guess I could just bring up in Milwaukee that I see that just has annoyed me for probably a decade is, like, you'll see Black politicians be like, I'm from 53206, the most incarcerated zip code, so I know XYZ, right? But then they go get elected and they expand policies that will incarcerate more Black people from 53206 or be silent on the ones that could prevent more. So there's this signaling that happens to try to be like, they went to Tech, they went to Marshall, they went to Bayview, they went to wherever. You know, they from the community, so I could trust this person. But when it comes to when they actually have power, what are they doing? And it's so far removed. So I think in terms of accountability, a lot of these people are showing up at different events in the community or doing different things or, like, you know, when they need it sort of transactionally. I think people should just be like, no, we're not going to let you. If I have this business opening or if I'm doing this cooperative that I worked blood, sweat and tears for many years to create, the accountability escapes us because we kind of like allow like the bandwidth of like these people to share space and look like they're doing or they're supportive of things in the community. But it's honestly just a photo op and very performative because their policies don't enable, you know, more Black home ownership, more Black, you know, small businesses to be able to get space or get, you know, things like that, or, you know, more green space, or like, oh, we're working to expand healthcare. They're just not even doing that. I think the accountability comes in us being like, oh, you know, the mayor or the county execs wants to show up at your thing. Like, no. Like, I don't know. They weren't there when we were building this, or we're trying to get these grants, or we're trying to do all this other stuff. So, nah, we good.
No, I completely agree. If the political narrative is built, the power structure is built around visibility, it makes sure certain people don't have access, and it makes sure that we take up space in spaces we're not supposed to be in. And if you're going to be an elected official, can I see your work? Because I know I will say for Black Milwaukee, if I was going to speak on my community, we recognize and laud amongst the folks who I'm using on the ground because I don't have other quick language, but we see each other. And I think that seeing and validating and loving on is present. And I think that if elected officials were thoroughly a part of that, they would understand how to operate within it. Because people are good for, you speak, I can step back. Like, I'm here because it's your event. I'm here what you need. Like, I'm here because of that. Or, like, I can't be there. I'm going to make sure there's some of this, or that goes through. I think that is a beautiful part of what's happening politically in this city. I think it's unfortunate that our elected leadership class isn't a part of it intimately. And that lack of intimacy, to me, makes it hard to authentically represent a group of people. And I think that the narratives about how bad Milwaukee is have been so embraced and made part of the fabric of people's identity that they don't even know how to see good in themselves, see good in the community. And the narrative is too easy to access, and then the electeds take it and move it forward and champion it. And it's like, that's not how the organizers in our city talk about the city. That's how you, because you get on the radio, you're on TV, you talk about it. But that's not how people talk about it around the dinner table or at the events. But you're not there. You're not intimate with the group. And your lack of intimacy means you're actually representing the skewed image of us.
You also made me think about, like, we all know people, Black folks in the community, that do so much with to little to no fanfare, little to no funding. People starting housing co-ops, starting community gardens, starting, you know, doing de-escalation stuff without needing to be sanctioned by the government or whatever like that, or interacting with the police. And I didn't mention it earlier, but that's part of my hope, because I see people doing it already, and we've been doing it. This is just a part of, like, who we are and our legacy and things like that. But that's the beauty in it. And I really like the point that you brought up, and you did say, like, there are positive things to say about 53206 or, you know, the north side of Milwaukee, Black Milwaukee. There are beautiful, beautiful things that happen organically all the time with no fanfare, unsexy people checking in on each other, bringing meals, bringing food, taking care of each other when they're sick. That happens consistently day in and day out.
All of that reminds me of Ella Baker saying strong people don't need strong leaders. You know, that quote's taken out of context all the time. But strong people don't need strong leaders. The question becomes, where do we get strong people from? From practicing. The more we practice, we build strong communities. And practicing, building strong communities, create strong people who do not need strong leaders. And I think that being able to understand what we're vibrating or trying to echo does not go into this system as it is. And it's the reason behind why a Black face in that electoral seat doesn't necessarily mean good things for our community, because it's just it's a strong person. And what we're looking for is a strong people, a collective, and being able to work together to build that collective comes through practice. So I think the call from us is really like, will y'all practice with us? Commit to the practice, be in practice of our community, be in practice of loving Black folks, and that will get us a little bit closer to the world we're trying to see.
That was Dr. Monique Liston and Nate Gilliam. Their conversation was produced by Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez as a part of our group chat series. We'll take one last break and then tell you about the Milwaukee Roots program and how they're rethinking teaching social studies. Keep listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. A new program is rethinking the way social studies is taught. Milwaukee Roots is a program out of Marquette University that aims to take social studies out of the classroom and into the streets of Milwaukee. To do this, the program invited teachers from across the city to take part in a week-long seminar in late June, where teachers went to locations like America's Black Holocaust Museum, Walker's Point, and the 16th Street Viaduct to get a hands-on education in Milwaukee history. Lake Effect Sam Woods joined these teachers on their bus ride to the lakefront to learn about the city's indigenous history and how teaching Milwaukee history can get students interested in social studies and their hometown.
The Lake Park Mound, what do you know about quote-unquote Indian mounds here?
That's Brian Rindfleisch, associate professor at Marquette University. He's leading a tour on the lakefront, hitting all the sites you might take a relative when they're visiting Milwaukee. Lake Drive, the Solomon Juno statue, Veterans Park, Cathedral Square, all the greatest downtown Milwaukee hits. But Brian isn't giving your standard welcome to Milwaukee tour. He's talking about the city's indigenous history, the role Solomon Juno's Menominee and French wife, Josette, played in founding the city, and the dozens of mounds that dotted the Milwaukee landscape before Europeans arrived. His audience is a group of Milwaukee teachers, taking part in a week-long summer program designed to help teachers incorporate Milwaukee history into their social studies programs. Right now, they've just completed a long, reflective walk along the coastline, imagining what the landscape looked like hundreds of years ago, with different indigenous nations coming and going, growing wild rice where the Milwaukee, Menominee, and Kinnickinnick rivers collide, and building ceremonial and burial mounds.
These Indian mounds are living testaments to that history. And unfortunately, southeastern Wisconsin used to be an epicenter for these mounds. It's part of what we call the Mississippian culture. The Mississippians' descendants are the Ho-Chunk, Menominee, Potawatomi, you name it.
But let's back up. What were your social studies classes like? Does the phrase social studies take you back to dusty textbooks and tales of dead white men? Did you learn more about things that happened thousands of miles away than what was in your hometown? Or perhaps you did learn about your hometown, but only what happened over 100 years ago. Milwaukee Roots is a program designed to change all that. It's officially described as a place-based, inquiry-centered approach to teaching history and civic engagement of Milwaukee's communities. In non-academic language, this means that the program is meant to help Milwaukee area teachers design curriculum around the history of Milwaukee's communities of color and move discussions of history from the textbook to the city streets. The seeds of Milwaukee Roots came from two directions. On one end, community historian Adam Carr and Marquette University professor of history Rob Smith put together 200 days of programming to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Fair Housing Marches around 2017. Part of that programming was discussions with young people at the Vell R. Phillips Juvenile Justice Center School, where Adam and Rob attempted to bring the Fair Housing Marches to life through archival footage and landmarks as innocuous as an ice cream stand.
We'll be looking at the footage and let's say, is that Tasty Twist? Which actually just closed. I'm like, yes. And it used to be the Community Custard Center. And then we get starting talking about like Titonia And then like the routes of the marches in a more intimate way, that kind of thing. One of the students said, and this actually was the first session we did, Rob, he said out loud, "I wish I'd known this story before today. I might not be here if I'd known it."
He said something also to the effect, like, I wish I'd known this earlier. It's too late now. I mean, 15-year-old thinking it's too late. Like, oh man, how do we walk away from that?
The impact was clear. When young people saw their hometown as a relevant historical site with stories to tell that directly impacted them and that they could relate to, the possibilities were endless. A few years later, Dr. Melissa Gibson, an associate professor at Marquette and now the faculty director of Milwaukee Roots, was running a credit recovery program at St. Joan Antietam High School. The program was designed for students who had failed virtual social studies classes during the pandemic and were at risk of not graduating. Gibson's approach was to get these kids out of the virtual classroom and into the world, treating social studies as a hands-on learning experience.
I would go in, we would have a three-hour seminar that I called like a place-based experience where we just went around the city and learned stories in Milwaukee. And when we didn't have specific stories in mind, we went out with an eye of curiosity, like what are the stories that we can uncover? Who is our city for? How should we tell the story of our Milwaukee?
Gibson worked to bring in as many community resources as possible to help her flesh out her tour of Milwaukee history, eventually connecting her with Adam and Rob. After two semesters, the program at St. Joan Antietam ended, and the three were searching for ways to build on what they had learned. A couple years and a few grant proposals later, Milwaukee Roots was born.
Our hypothesis is that by engaging young people through their teachers, through this kind of contextually relevant, place-based learning, critical inquiry about local history, that their understanding of themselves and their communities will be transformed, and that that will lead to some kind of measurable change in achievement, in particularly in their history and civics knowledge.
For teachers like Sepia Grace Buchanan, Milwaukee Roots has given her the civics education that she did not receive. When she was in school, she remembers her social studies classes mostly revolving around the memorization of facts inside the classroom.
My upbringing was all about what was in the book, nothing outside of the book. It was just the book. When I say nothing outside of that book, we no experiences brought in, no real world, real life experiences. But I'm grateful that I'll be able to take this experience back to my students because I'm learning things I never knew about Milwaukee.
But Milwaukee history was in her blood, and she learned that history through stories her grandfather told her about his life. Her grandfather moved to Milwaukee from Mississippi in the 1950s for the good-paying manufacturing jobs Milwaukee was famous for at the time. He only had a sixth-grade education, but eventually got a job laying concrete for the city and became part of the Walnut Street Club, a social club for the Walnut Street neighborhood that still meets annually today to keep childhood memories alive. And Walnut Street used to be a hub for Black-owned businesses in Milwaukee, before urban renewal policies and freeway construction obliterated the once thriving neighborhood. Buchanan said that while she has heard stories of Walnut Street from her grandfather, the Milwaukee Roots program has helped provide context for the historical significance of the neighborhood.
So to hear him talk about it, now learning about it, I've like connected all the dots together. And it's like, oh my gosh, like Granddad, when he would tell me about Walnut Street and how it used to be, now just seeing the pictures and the images and learning where that is on the timeline, like that's just, yeah, mind-boggling.
Beyond contextualizing her family's Milwaukee experience, Sepia Grace is already planning to adjust her existing curriculum. In the past, she's asked students to pick a historical figure and learn history through that figure's lens. From now on, her students will do the same thing, but with a local focus.
They'll choose a person from Milwaukee. Bell R. Phillips, Father Grappi, Dr. Coleman, you know, there's so many names that I've learned. And even some of our instructors, Dr. Sergio, that could be a person. And so they'll study that person, learn about that person, and hopefully we can get some people to come in, we can get out and bring it all together because they do not know the history of their city, just like I didn't.
The Dr. Sergio she's referring to is Dr. Sergio Gonzalez, an assistant professor at Marquette University and historian focused on the development of Latino communities in the Midwest. and he's made a big impact on the 46-year-old Buchanan's own academic career, convincing her to get a PhD in history.
So I was toggling between reading and history, and when I came to the MKE Roots program, I think Melissa spoke. She was, oh my gosh, so engaging. And then Sergio got up to tell his story about how he started his PhD and how he was in the Milwaukee Historical Society. It just was like an aha moment for me, like, okay, this is what I'm supposed to do. And every day just cements it day after day that, yeah, I'm going into history.
Back at the lakefront, Brian Rindfleisch, who we met at the beginning of this story giving a tour of the area's indigenous history, made sure to keep his story relevant to today. While it is common in history textbooks to treat indigenous history as something that only took place hundreds of years ago, Rindfleisch explains how Potawatomi Casino and the Indian Community School in Franklin trace their origins to the 1970s, when a group of activists occupied the abandoned McKinley Coast Guard station, demanding its return to indigenous nations.
The occupation in the early 1970s by the local American Indian Movement chapter, and they cited the Treaty of Fort Laramie of 1868 that cited that whenever federal property was abandoned by the U.S. government, it reverted to the control of the original inhabitants of land. And in this case, Native peoples, right? So like they use that treaty, which is also being used nationally at Alcatraz and other places around the United States, to justify the takeover of abandoned federal property. And they were one of the only successful cases in all of the United States to actually be successful, where the state government and the national government conceded, probably because it was literally abandoned and low stakes compared to something like Alcatraz. But at the same time, that space became the first Indian community school. And then through a complicated narrative of politics and politicking throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s, at some point you have the Forest County Potawatomi and the Indian Community School converging on that space using the Treaty of Chicago of 1833. And today you have ICS in Franklin, Wisconsin, and you have the Potawatomi Casino and Hotel.
If you follow Wisconsin and national politics, you likely know that what counts as history is up for debate right now. In recent years, state governments and school boards across the country have banned teachings of history that examine the role of racism in government and social institutions, often on the grounds that it only teaches kids to hate these institutions. In response, Dr. Melissa Gibson points to Act 31, a three-decade-old state law put in place after historically inaccurate teachings led to violence in northern Wisconsin. She says this law underscores the importance of programs like Milwaukee Roots, both because state law mandates it and because it helps students develop their own interpretations of history based on primary sources.
In one way, at a very like structural level, part of the response in Wisconsin to these political debates is we have a law that says that we have to teach an inclusive history of our communities. And the reason we have that law is because we weren't doing it and it led to violence. Right, the Walleye Wars of the 1980s, the fights over treaty rights in northern Wisconsin. The theory of change in Act 31 was, well, if we teach an accurate, inclusive history in our schools, maybe we can avoid these kinds of actual physical violent conflicts in the future. So one, we're helping teachers to do that. And in a polarized time, it's even more important that we equip folks with accurate history. And part of what we're doing is laying the evidence in front of students and saying, what do you see? The story I tell over and over is of a student at St. Joan who, when we learned about the open housing marches, and I'm showing them pictures of walking across 16th Street Bridge and the white supremacist marchers at the end of the bridge. And this was an African-American student from the north side of Milwaukee who said, but my teacher said that there was no racism in the north. And I'm like, well, here are the images. What do you think?
Whether marked by a plaque, carried in stories through generations, or unmarked entirely, Milwaukee exudes history. For Adam Carr, one of the originators of the Milwaukee Roots Project, learning Milwaukee history is an active process that begets more stories. He believes that the more Milwaukee's young people know about their home, the more likely they are to add their own stories to Milwaukee's lore.
Actually, I never started learning history because I cared about history. I started wanting to know context for how we got where we are. And I think through looking at history, it also helped me feel a sense of potential about the present. Because if your city's a place where stories can't be written that are worth recording, why would I stay? I want to have a story that's worth recording.
For Lake Effect, I'm Sam Woods.
Milwaukee Roots is a program out of Marquette University's Center for Urban Research, Teaching, and Outreach. You can find more information about the program at wuwm.com. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Just search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. WUWM also has a new politics podcast called Swing State of the Union. It explores why Wisconsin is a deeply purple state and why Wisconsin is so important in this election year. All episodes are available now at WUWM.com, and you can find it wherever you like to listen to podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn what policing will look like in Milwaukee during the RNC, and find out what groups who support unhoused people are planning to do during the event. That's tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.